Welcome to Star Trek Age of Discovery. I'm Adele Austin Anderson.
And I'm Gary Anderson.
And we're a married couple who are longtime fans of Star Trek.
Yep, we're back.
Yeah, so today we're providing a review of Season 3 of Star Trek Strange New Worlds. Before we begin, please note that our analysis contains major spoilers. So we recommend watching all of the Season 3 episodes first before listening to this podcast. So, Gary, let's start off with the overall critique for Season 3 through an analysis of character arcs.
Okay, sure. Let's start off with Batel and Pike.
Okay.
The romance between the two captains, Christopher Pike and Marie Batel, served as the primary emotional anchor for Pike throughout Season 3, shifting from Batel's recovery from a Gorn infection to a grand mythological sacrifice.
The overall arc spanned the entire season.
Yes.
Giving the relationship significant weight, but the pacing of the necessary plot mechanics often felt abrupt or rushed.
The initial stages dealing with Batel's near-death experience from the Gorn created high emotional stakes. The solution, using the Chimera flower to transform her into a human-Gorn hybrid, was a major and controversial plot point that forced Pike to confront his significant other's fate and bodily autonomy. However, the sequence in the episode Shuttle to Confori, where Batel's infection returned and the cure was introduced, was criticized for being too short and abrupt, as it quickly escalated Batel's condition from cured to having only days to live.
The pivot in the finale, where Batel develops cosmic abilities and her altered genetics link her to the ancient evil Vesda, was noted as a slightly puzzling turn of events that felt contrived. The show quickly established Batel as a destined universal protector who must become the beholder, the eternal warden. While this was necessary to resolve the character's presence before the original series timeline, the sci-fi mechanism felt like a sudden, out-of-nowhere escalation to justify her exit. The emotional success of the storyline rests mainly on the powerful performances of its leads.
Absolutely. So let's talk about those. Let's talk first about Anson Mount. Mount delivered an emotionally resonant portrayal of a man struggling with foreknowledge of his own destiny, who is forced to watch the love of his life face her own fate, and which I think actually added power to the moments that in that last episode. He was praised for his ability to navigate the complex emotional ebbs and flows, showcasing a softer side of Pike while still being the commanding captain. His acting in the finale, where he experiences the illusory life with Batel, was described as amazing.
And now let's look at Melanie Scrofano, who portrayed Captain Batel. Scrofano was an integral part of Pike's journey. She successfully conveyed a character facing tremendous vulnerability and trauma, particularly in the early recovery episodes. She was praised for being at her best and her most vulnerable simultaneously in her final scenes, communicating depth despite the limited time afforded to the character throughout the season.
Mm-hmm.
The resolution of their relationship was highly emotional, but also raised significant questions regarding series continuity.
You know, we're going to come back to that on several times because, okay, you know, we understand we had a 10-episode season, but it seemed as if there were certain plot points and certain storylines that weren't completely invested in,
even
knowing that they had 10 episodes. And in some cases, some of the episodes, let's just say, wasted opportunities actually help.
Right, get in the way of the main storylines.
Exactly, yep. Exactly. The core of the finale's resolution was Battelle's gift to Pike, a life lived in an accelerated fantasy that mirrored the structure of the beloved TNG episode, The Inner Light. In this shared experience, they married, grew old, raised a daughter, and Pike even avoided his destined accident. This provided a deeply bittersweet and poignant emotional conclusion, allowing Pike the closure of a life he never thought he could have, ending with his acceptance that memory is as real as the present.
The major critique of the resolution, however, concerns how it impacts Pike's established future.
Right.
Critics pointed out that Pike's eventual fate is to be with Vina on Talos IV. Having experienced a full decades-long true love with Battelle, it felt narratively incongruous that Pike would later accept an illusionary life with Vina, a person he barely knew, over the memory of the deep connection he had with Battelle.
Yeah.
The creative team noted they used the fantasy structure to give Pike the true love they knew he couldn't have in real time. But for many, it complicated the emotional logic of his ultimate destiny.
Yeah, yeah. So true.
And if you think back to the second season of Discovery, where Pike meets Vina again, man, there was a lot of chemistry between them. And you just thought, yes, this is his true love.
Right.
You know, right here. So, you know, to have Battelle, who throughout this season three, where Battelle was actually on the ship, I felt that the writers really didn't do her justice by developing her throughout the season. If they're going to have her there, then actually let's see that growth, you know, episode by episode. Yeah. And that really didn't happen.
Yeah, yeah, no. There were some episodes where she wasn't available or in them at all.
Right.
Or she only pops up in these group scenes where she's in the background.
Exactly.
Yeah, yeah. Overall, the Battelle storyline provided a necessary exploration of Pike's mortality and vulnerability, anchored by excellent performances. But we do have to acknowledge that.
Yes.
However, it was hampered by rushed, complex sci-fi plot devices used to facilitate her eventual exit from the series. And if anybody can explain to me exactly what the heck was going on scientifically in that last episode.
Oh, wow. Yeah. You just had to get past that.
You just had to hand wave and just go by it.
Yes, go by it. Yes. So now we're going to move to another topic, and that is Spock's romances.
Yeah.
One of the major subplots of Strange New Worlds Season 3 centers on Spock's emotional evolution and shifting relationships. Much of his inner turbulence stems from his attempt to reconcile with Christine Chapel, only to discover she has moved on and is now romantically involved with research scientist Dr. Roger Corby, introduced in the episode Wedding Bell Blues.
After accepting that Chapel has found happiness elsewhere, Spock begins to form a deeper connection with La'an, Nooni, and Singh, their bond developing through shared moments of dance and mutual trust. What begins as friendship gradually turns romantic, culminating in a kiss during the retro holodeck-style episode, A Space Adventure Hour. The chemistry between them feels genuine and offers Spock a rare opportunity to explore vulnerability in a confined, emotionally charged setting.
Yet, by focusing so heavily on his romantic entanglements,
ooh, man,
the season often reduces Spock's personal journey to a human-centered love story. This emphasis comes at the expense of exploring his command potential and his ongoing struggle to balance emotional expression with Vulcan discipline, the very duality that defines his most enduring character arcs.
Still, what bothered me most as a viewer is how little the writers do with to Pring's presence and legacy in this story. And I was really, I kept thinking about her throughout this entire season. The first two seasons of Strange New Worlds gave us a substantial T'Pring storyline, establishing the betrothal, cultural stakes, and the friction between Spock's duties and his obligations to Vulcan ritual. Given that setup, and given the TOS episode Amok Time, which explicitly shows Spock still bound to T'Pring years later, the relative silence about her in season three feels like a deliberate omission rather than an oversight. Omitting any meaningful follow-up makes Spock's new romantic freedom feel narratively cheapened, in my opinion.
Yes.
It's harder to accept his rapid emotional turns when the show hasn't reckoned with the partner the canon says should still matter to him.
Yes, yes. So, as a reviewer, I found the season emotionally engaging in patches. The romance beats are earnest and often well acted, but ultimately uneven in its priorities. The show chooses immediacy,
yep,
a handful of compelling interpersonal scenes, over the harder work of reconciling those scenes with Spock's long-term continuity and his vocational arc toward command. That choice produces satisfying moments, but also a sense of narrative shortchanging. Spock grows, yes, but mostly in ways that serve present tense drama rather than the slow canonical forging of the Spock we meet in the original series.
Yeah, yeah. And with a show like this, where the majority of the characters are legacy characters, where we have some sense of where they're going to go,
yes,
in the both the near future and the long-term future,
yes,
it becomes really problematic for us to see things work in such a manner where it doesn't seem if it's going to last long.
Yes.
That this is just solving a thematic or a romantic or dramatic purpose for the moment, as opposed to something that's going to be connected to who we know they become.
Right.
And speaking of characters that are legacy characters, here's one that we know very little about, although we know we've seen him in other series, and that's Dr. M'Banga. I thought that we should say right off the bat, we think that Babs Olusemukin is probably the best actor in the entire cast, based on his ability to play really challenging and layered performances, some cases with very little say or do.
Right.
And that was on display this season.
Yes.
Particularly this season. Dr. Joseph M'Banga's arc, which began with the revelation of his warrior past and culminated in his murder of Ambassador Doc Ra in season two, continued in season three with a decisive, though controversial, final chapter.
The storyline is highly dense, weaving M'Banga's personal reckoning into a high-stakes action plot. The primary narrative engine of the episode Shuttle to Kinfori is Captain Batel's life-threatening Gorn infection, which requires M'Banga to obtain the rare Chimera Blossom from a restricted zone.
Mm-hmm.
This cure mission is criticized by some as an abrupt setup, serving mainly as a MacGuffin to place M'Banga and Pike in hostile territory.
The core plot, however, is the arrival of Bytha, the daughter of the slain Klingon ambassador Doc Ra, who seeks justice or honor for her father's death. This forces M'Banga to finally drop the ambiguity from season two and confess to the assassination. This direct confrontation and the subsequent admission, where M'Banga states he intentionally killed a mass murderer willingly, is a powerful and long-awaited plot point. The pacing of this confrontation is sharp, but the need to cram in a zombie-like horror element, the cure mission, and the Klingon honor duel into the single episode led some critics, and the two of us included, to feel the entire storyline was overstuffed and could have benefited from being spread out across multiple installments.
Babs Olsson-Moken's performance is consistently cited as a major strength of the episode and a character's arc. He brings a profound stoic gravity to M'Benga, expertly balancing the character's dual nature as a compassionate healer and a battle-hardened warrior haunted by his past.
In the pivotal confession and duel sequence, Olsson-Moken's delivery is commanding, portraying a man who accepts the monster he keeps hidden while still adhering to a personal code of justice. He is lauded for bringing incredible depth and nuance to the role, fully selling M'Benga's internal conflict and immense likability despite his morally questionable actions. Olsson-Moken is often called gravitas personified and successfully fuses the character's complex aspects into a single compelling performance.
The official resolution of the Dokra incident in Shuttle to Kunphori is the most contentious point of the storyline.
Yeah. So this is a strong case, basically, when we look at the personal resolution for M'Benga.
Okay.
M'Benga defeats Bytha, but holds back from killing her, choosing mercy and showing growth by not succumbing to his Protocol 12 persona. Bytha's subsequent choice to sacrifice herself to ensure their escape provides a fitting, if quick, closure to the Klingon honor plot, turning an enemy into a tragic ally.
This is widely considered disappointing and too easy. Mm-hmm. Captain Pike, placing his loyalty and friendship above Starfleet regulations, chooses to deliberately ignore M'Benga's confession. I mean, and this happens very quickly.
It sure does.
Instead of maybe taking an episode or two for Pike to really consider it, because this is a very serious thing.
Yeah.
He decides right at the end of the episode that it's not going to go any further.
Right.
Pike states that the entire mission was unsanctioned and that if a report were filed, he would claim M'Benga merely told a story under duress to save his captain's life. This decision grants M'Benga a quick absolution and ensures he faces no formal consequences for murdering a Federation ambassador. While this affirms Pike's character as fiercely loyal, many feel it cheapens the moral ambiguity of the season 2 ending by sidestepping the major moral and legal debate in favor of a power of friendship solution.
Yeah, I agree. I think that that's the biggest problem with that story.
Yes.
M'Benga's storyline in season 3 is split between his personal plot and a subplot involving Ensign Dana Gamble. In Through the Lens of Time, he serves as an emotional counterpoint to M'Benga's dark past and a catalyst for a new threat.
The subplot features junior medical officer Ensign Dana Gamble, played by actor Chris Myers in that episode, which is strategically positioned to reinforce M'Benga's identity as a healer and a mentor in the wake of the violent Shuttle to Kunphori resolution.
Now let's talk about some of the plot points and emotional functions. The mentor-protege relationship that he builds with Gamble. Gamble is introduced as M'Benga's enthusiastic, bright-eyed medical assistant, a new protege filling in the gap left by a Nurse Chapel's absence at the beginning of the season. His excitement about his first away mission and the potential for discovery contrasts sharply with M'Benga's world weariness and the trauma of the Klingon War. This relationship shows a softer, nurturing side of M'Benga moving past the monster he confessed to being.
Now, Gamble is tragically and gruesomely blinded by an ancient alien artifact on Vadia 9. When beamed back to the Enterprise, Dr. Mbenga's medical ingenuity is tested. The cruel twist is Mbenga's discovery that Gamble is clinically brain dead, yet possessed by a malevolent extra-dimensional entity called the Vesta.
And here's the ultimate test. The Vesta wearing Gamble's body as a shell can access his memories using the pain of Mbenga's past, specifically the loss of his own daughter, Rukia, to taunt and manipulate him.
Yes.
This personal assault is designed to paralyze Mbenga, making him hesitate to take lethal action against a body that still looks and talks like the young man he cared for. This is the crucial moral test. Will the monster, the necessary killer, emerge, or will the healer prevail, even at a great cost?
And Mbenga's reluctance to kill Gamble's body allows the Vesta to briefly escape, murder a security officer, and attempt to commandeer the ship.
Mm-hmm.
In the final confrontation, it takes intervention from Commander Palia and Ensign Scotty to kill the host body and capture the Vesta entity. And Mbenga is left with the heartbreaking duty of reporting the death of his protege to his family, marking another devastating loss for the compassionate doctor.
So let's just do a little assessment of the performances and the narrative in this section. Babs Olusemukin's performance excels here, grounding the high concept horror with deep emotional realism. His struggle to reconcile the brain scans with the person standing before him is palpable, showcasing the immense vulnerability and pain of a doctor who has already lost a daughter and is being forced to confront that loss again. His scene informing Gamble's family is a quietly powerful moment of tragic sacrifice.
The Gamble subplot succeeds in several ways.
It provides a poignant personal consequences of deep space exploration, highlighting the red shirt trope with emotional weight.
It effectively introduces a terrifying new galactic threat, the Vesta, that appears to be pure, unreasoning evil, in contrast to the nuanced morality of the Klingon War.
It forces Mbenga into a new no-win scenario, forcing him to choose between saving an innocent soul and protecting the crew. His failure to make the lethal choice, born of compassion and mentorly affection, highlights the price he pays for trying to suppress the warrior and return to being only a healer.
While Shuttle to Kenfori was about Mbenga's dark past, the Gamble subplot is about his vulnerable presence and the emotional toll his journey continues to take. In summary, Mbenga's Season 3 storyline showcases Babs Olusemukin's excellent nuanced performance while bringing definitive closure to the Dark Dakra storyline. However, the pacing is frenetic and the institutional resolution is often viewed as a missed opportunity for a more profound moral exploration within the Star Trek framework.
Yeah. So let's move on to another storyline. Kirk and the crew that he soon will be the captain of. One of the highlights of Strange New Worlds Season 3 has been watching the show develop James T. Kirk, not yet the legendary captain of the Enterprise, but a younger officer still learning the craft of leadership. In The Salat Who Ate Its Tail, we see this most clearly through his interactions with the three familiar Enterprise figures, Uhura, Scotty, and Spock. The episode isn't just about the mission that binds them. It's about how Kirk navigates trust, humility, and the art of command amongst peers who won't simply follow orders because of his name. What unfolds is a subtle, deeply human exploration about what leadership looks like before it's polished into a legend.
Okay, so we're going to look at each of those Enterprise characters in a relationship with Kirk one by one.
Right.
We're going to start with Uhura. What really stood out to me in The Sailor Who Ate His Tail is how Uhura steps into that mediator space between Kirk's ambition and the crew's readiness. She doesn't claim a deep history of knowing him inside out, but she does know from firsthand experience that Kirk is capable of leadership. She remembers the moment he convinced her that she had a unique purpose as a Starfleet officer, and she brings that belief into this mission. When Scotty's bluntness and Kirk's bold gambits collide, Uhura tries to steer the conversation back to the team, to the mission, to what's real. But because Kirk is fueled by instinct right now, he brushes her off. And then when an error in his judgment shakes everything, it's Uhura who stays steady. She doesn't bail on him. Her faith in him doesn't depend on perfect performance. She's there, quietly holding the possibility that he will rise to the occasion. That kind of support feels rare and deeply human in a show full of explosions and high-stakes drama.
And that interaction, that aspect, that dynamic in their relationship,
yep,
syncs clearly with the relationship between Uhura and Kirk in the original series.
Yes, yes.
So the times that she said things to him in regards to support,
right,
in regards to...
Or just a look.
Look, or looks, yeah, because she had a lot of reaction shots because they took her lines away.
Right.
But there was a number of cases where that behavior, now we see where it comes from and where the understanding that's underneath it.
Yes.
And so this is an example of what we're talking about in regards to doing things where the characters are developing.
Right.
And we're seeing how they're going to lead to the people that we've met before.
Exactly.
So now let's talk a little bit about Scotty. Scotty's presence in this episode hits with an uneasy weight. He's not his usual upbeat self. The memory of the USS Star Diver Rex still looms, and he's wrestling with the idea that maybe the people giving orders don't always have the best decision tree mapped for the trenches. When Kirk floats a daring fix, Scotty doesn't mince words. He sees the risk. He smells the potential disaster, and he tells Kirk outright, it's a bad call. That tension, hothead and patient captain versus seasoned scarred engineer, is a full spark. What it's more than just banter, it highlights Kirk's tipping point. Scotty's doubt isn't personal, it's born of survival of consequences. And because Kirk doesn't fully listen, the fallout feels that much heavier.
Mm-hmm.
I came away thinking, if Kirk is going to lead, he'll need to win over people like Scotty, not just by charm or guts, but by showing he's earned their trust after they've seen too much. I think that's an important statement to make, too.
Yep. So Martin Quinn's portrayal of Montgomery Scotty Scott is in Star Trek Strange New Worlds is nothing short of inspired.
Mm-hmm.
It's a depth balance of homage and originality.
Mm-hmm.
As a native Scott, Quinn brings a level of authenticity to the role that was absent from James Doohan's much-beloved interpretation, grounding Scotty's quick wit and technical genius in a genuine accent and cultural cadence that feels wholly natural. And in fact, I was reading an article earlier today in which they said, you know, they actually allowed Quinn to actually throw in Scottish words into the dialogue.
They wouldn't want to do that on any of the other opportunities where we've had Scots portrayed in Star Trek.
Right.
Because they've usually been portrayed by people who aren't Scottish.
Yeah, so there was a one interview where Peck says that, oh, that Mark Quinn, he's going to get fired. And he was just joking. And it was just because the fact that Quinn would put in these words again, were not originally in the dialogue.
He was constantly ad-libbing.
He was just making it more true to somebody. If they're a Scot, how would they speak and what words would they use?
I see.
So beyond the charm and humor traditionally associated with the character, Quinn also introduces a quiet pathos as the lone survivor of the Star Diver. His Scotty carries the weight of trauma and a lingering hesitancy to place his full trust in his superiors. This emotional depth adds a new dimension to a fan favorite role, allowing viewers to see the beginning of the legendary engineer's resilience and humanity. Quinn's performance honors Duhan's legacy while boldly expanding the emotional contours of the character for a new generation.
And again, that's the way it ought to be done.
That's the way it should be done, yes.
Now let's move on to one of the more popular legacy characters, Spock. Spock's role in the episode is subtle but significant. When the mission unravels and Kirk begins to doubt himself, his decisions, his command style, it's Spock who offers the comm anchor. He watches Kirk's impulses crash into reality. He doesn't lecture, he reflects. His logical steadiness shows Kirk a different way forward. Rely on the crew. Listen. Temper the boldness with humility. In that case, in that sense, Spock acts like the moral and the operational compass that Kirk needs, though maybe doesn't know how badly yet. After the mistake that shook Kirk's confidence, the scene where Spock quietly states that leadership is as much about enabling others as it is about making the calls really land. It felt like Kirk's turning point, not just to stop being impulsive, but to start trusting his team, which in turn makes the team trust him. Watching that begin in this episode gives me hope for Kirk's maturation as a leader. And we get a glimpse of how Spock will be a part of that journey in a deeply resonant way.
So by the end of the Salad Who Ate His Tail, what stands out isn't Kirk's mistakes, but how the people around him shape what kind of leader he's becoming. Uhura believes in his capacity to do better, even when he stumbles. Scotty challenges him to respect the weight of consequence, reminding him that leadership isn't about daring the odds, but living with the aftermath. And Spock, ever the steady counterpoint, gives him the framework to transform self-doubt into reflection and restraint. Together, they form a kind of informal council, not of subordinates, but of equals who push and steady him in different ways. Watching Kirk learn to hear them, to balance confidence with humility, feels like the show quietly preparing us for the captain he's destined to be. It's not about myth building yet.
Right.
It's about the messy, necessary middle ground where great leaders are forged.
Yep, that's true. That's true. Okay, now let's talk a little bit about Commander Una Chin Riley. She was another character who we want to highlight in regards to her storyline this season. Number one, Commander Una Chin Riley in Star Trek Strange New Worlds Season 3 is primarily utilized in a supporting and command-focused role, having been cleared of her court-martial and embracing her position without the pressure of hiding her Illyrian heritage.
Una's narrative this season focuses on showcasing her command abilities and leadership style. In Captain Pike's absence, you know, during the shuttle to Kinfori, she takes the comm, prioritizing the crew's safety and strategic protocol over high-risk action. This highlights her as a highly competent, strategic, and graceful potential future captain, reinforcing the deep admiration and trust she shares with Pike. Her role solidifies the idea that she is now a freer, lighter version of herself without the need for secrecy.
Sure. While her command episodes are strong, Una's individual story takes a back seat to the main ensemble, with her major personal development centered on a comedic one-off romance. Her use often serves to facilitate other characters' stories, like Ortega's, or anchors a specific episode's genre, like the comedy involving Doug. The Vulcan named Doug, played by Patton Oswalt, is introduced in the episode 4 1/2 Vulcans, and we will now talk a little bit about Doug.
Yeah, Doug is a Vulcan spiritual guide and an expert in locating and altering Katras, that is the individual Vulcan consciousness. He is sought out by Una and Spock when a crew member's affliction requires his specific expertise. He is noted for being more passionate than most Vulcans, as he was raised by parents interested in human cultures, which is suggested to explain his human name.
Doug. Doug is an old flame of Una's, and she is notably reluctant to see him because their sexual chemistry remains explosive. Explosive. Even after their breakup, suggesting a strong romantic and physical connection between the two of them. To avoid flirting, Una tells Doug that Spock is her husband, and the interaction between the generally stoic Una and the passionate Doug is played for comedy, and it is actually the best part of the episode.
Right. Una's concerns regarding Lieutenant Erica Ortega's arise in Shuttle to Kinfori, following Ortega's ordeal with the Gorn in the season 3 opener.
While Una is commanding the Enterprise, she notices Ortega's deliberately sabotaged the safe plan, which was to stay at a low impulse to avoid detection by the Klingons, in favor of a riskier strategy, which is dropping to 1/8 impulse to force the ship to use Ortega's thermosphere escape maneuver, thereby distracting the Klingons and allowing Pike and M'Benga to beam aboard. This action endangers the crew by forcing the Klingon cruiser to spot them.
Una demonstrates perceptive and strong leadership by immediately recognizing Ortega's insubordinate behavior was a calculated risk, likely stemming from her trauma distress after the Gorn attack. Una is firm yet understanding. She pulls Ortega's from active duty and assigns her to a warrant officer for chain of command training. This is done not just as punishment for endangering the crew, but because Una is perceptive enough to see that Ortega needs guidance and may have returned to duty too soon, with her trauma leading to rash, high-risk decisions. This handling of discipline emphasizes Una's command style, which is firm on protocol while also caring for her officers as people.
Yeah, yeah. So now let's talk a little bit about our hotshot pilot, Erica Ortega, who went through some stuff this season. Lieutenant Ortega's arc is the best character development of her character of season 3. Finally, granting the popular helmsman the long-awaited spotlight episode that fans had desired. The arc is centered on the deep trauma and PTSD that she suffered after being critically wounded and barely escaping a Gorn vessel in the season premiere. This trauma led to erratic behavior in earlier episodes, but the season effectively builds towards a climax in episode 9 with Terrarium.
In the episode Terrarium, Ortegas is thrown into a survival scenario after her shuttle is sucked into a wormhole and she crash lands on a desolate moon. This experience forces her to face her deep Gorn-related trauma head-on when she encounters a stranded Gorn pilot.
Ortega's greatest lesson is the realization that the Gorn are not simply feral space monsters. Through their shared desperate situation, she overcomes her fear and hatred to forge a working relationship and eventually a deep, genuine bond with the Gorn. They achieve a peaceful coexistence, sharing food, building shelter, and even teaching each other rudimentary games. She learns that the Gorn are capable of more than violence and that under certain circumstances, they can be reasoned with and communicated with.
In a poignant display of her own healing, Ortegas tells her Gorn companion that neither of them is broken anymore, signaling the inner strength and recovery she found through the ordeal.
This learning is tragically underscored when the Enterprise rescue crew, led by La'an, arrives and immediately shoots the Gorn pilot on sight, mistaking the creature for an attacker. Ortegas is left in a complicated emotional space where she has lost a new friend at the hands of an old friend, reinforcing the lesson that while she overcame her personal hatred, Starfleet as a whole was still too quick to reach for the phaser.
Melissa Navia's portrayal of Ortegas has been widely praised by reviewers who note that her performance is deeply grounded and makes the character incredibly relatable, allowing her to carve out a spot as a standout among legacy characters. In Terrarium, her acting showcase in the episode is riveting, effectively conveying the character's sarcastic humor, problem-solving resourcefulness, and the profound emotional change she undergoes during her time alone with her enemy. Really happy that Melissa had this opportunity.
Absolutely.
I mean, it's such a well-written episode. Mm-hmm. But we're going to get to that in a moment. In that, Gary and I are now going to rank the Strange New World Season 3 episodes, moving from our least favorite to the best of the season. For each episode, we'll give a brief justification for its placement. So, Gary, let's begin with your number 10, the one that landed at the bottom of your ranking.
Okay, well, that's easy. It was pretty consistent throughout the season, and that is Wedding Bell Blues. I put that at number 10. The only positive thing I can say out of that entire episode is Ethan Peck's performance. He has that beautiful speech during the faux wedding, which he actually conveys a great deal of the personal and emotional conflict he's been going through. And he is pitch perfect in regards to how he does that role. The rest of it, the Trelane of it, the goofiness, I could not stand it. And I was really, really tired of dealing with stories about Spock and his failed romances by that point.
Just the second episode.
But we had been dealing with that since the end of season 2.
Okay.
You know, a couple other things I thought that were really challenging about it was the undermining of Chapel's character. She had made this growth. She found this new boyfriend. And now she was going back to this old relationship because of magic, because of Trelane. It also lacked the narrative stakes and thematic points that I think that were important to so many other great episodes from this series. There was over-reliance on Spock's comedy. It was undeveloped supporting plot lines and canon contradictions. You created this connection between the Q continuum and Trelane, which fans had talked about a great deal, but it didn't make sense other than just replicate many of the plot points from the Squire of Gothos. specifically the ending of the episode. So I didn't like it.
Hard to tell.
Yeah.
Hard to tell.
Yeah.
So I did not feel as strongly as Gary did about this episode as far as my dislike for it. I did feel like it was one of the weaker episodes, but it's definitely not my number 10.
What is your number 10, Adele?
My number 10 is Shuttle to Kinfori. So this was my least favorite episode because of the generic zombie Klingon plot that felt completely unnecessary.
The plant zombies?
The plant zombies.
That want to eat flesh.
Right. And the forced attempt to resolve M'Benga's dark past came across as misplaced and unearned, giving the complexity the intrigue of his character.
It was played well, and Babs was fantastic in it.
Right.
But it was placed in the wrong episode.
Agreed.
So let's go to what's your number 9, Adele, since we got you on the spot?
Okay. My number 9 is definitely 4.5 Vulcans.
Woo!
So honestly, this episode fell flat for me. The idea of the crew becoming full Vulcans led to too much reductive comedy and hand-waving in the script that kept pulling me out of the story. The only reason why it is not my 10th pick is due to the stellar comic performance by Patton Oswalt in his role of the Vulcan Doug. And it was not only his scenes with number one, but also the post-credit scene.
Oh, that post-credit scene is to die for.
Yeah.
It is really funny.
It's funny. Yeah, exactly.
Well, my number 9 is Shuttle to Kinfori. And outside of the excellent character work and focus on M'Benga, the rest of the episode, as we have said, was pretty lousy. A reliance on the overdone tropes, like the plant zombie, underdeveloped A-plot with regards to getting the Chimera flower, Pike's moral compromise by accepting the fact that his chief medical officer has admitted to committing assassination of a Federation ambassador on his ship.
Right.
And the forced dialogue that just really didn't work, and the contrived plot device of the magic flower, the Chimera flower. It just seemed, this will fix everything.
Right. And it didn't. Yeah. So what was your number 8?
My number 8 was 4.5 Vulcans. Your number 9 was 4.5 Vulcans. My number 8. So it's in the bottom 4.
Okay.
That was pretty lousy. Right. As I said, the best thing about it is the post-credit scene with Doug, between Doug and Spock. But there's contradictions in Vulcan lore in regards to the way the characters are played out.
Mm-hmm.
Science didn't make any sense. There's repetitive plot points, a lack of consequences and wasted potential in the episode. The Uhura's actions with Beta, where she basically uses a mind meld to correct him, was morally ambiguous. Is that something that she should have been doing?
Right.
And just because she's now embodying a Vulcan, we should not assume that she has lost her moral core.
Right.
In fact, that was one of the biggest problems, the changes in behavior of the characters who became Klingon. And then also the pacing and tonal issues that the episode had. It just continued to be problematic for me.
All right. So for me, this one had a few laughs, but it was just another holodeck gone wrong story, making it feel slightly disposable compared to the season's more ambitious episodes.
Yeah. So you want to go to number 7?
Yeah, I'll go.
Okay.
Okay, so my number 7 was Wedding Bell Blues. For me, it was a serviceable episode that reintroduced a classic canon character. However, dedicating an entire episode to the Chapel Spock Corby love triangle didn't feel like the best use of limited time in a 10-episode season.
Yep. Oh, so you want to hear what mine is?
Yeah.
Number seven was A Space Adventure Hour.
Oh, okay.
Now, the main thing I liked about this episode was the meta commentary on Star Trek's legacy. I mean, you basically had the Lucille Ball defending the show's attitude towards against the studio.
Right.
And the whole, the behind the scenes kind of drama that the show was under.
Right.
You even had a, what I thought was a fairly good imitation of Gene Roddenberry done by Anson Mount.
Right.
But the main problems was, you know, is another holodeck episode, and I'm tired of those because they only had a handful of tropes that you can play with. A lack of real stakes or sci-fi ambition with the episode, and questionable canon continuity dealing with, specifically with the holodeck, because I understand there's a animated series episode where they have a device like the holodeck. They don't call it the holodeck. But I really think that for the live action shows, they should be use information coming out of the animated series sparingly.
Yes.
And that was one of the things that I thought, when you look at all what it's capable of doing and what you have to make it available to do, it really makes you question why something like this would even be built as early in the history of Star Trek.
Yeah. Yeah, agreed.
Yeah.
So it seems like what we do is that we definitely agree on what the bottom four
episodes do. We just don't have them in the same order.
Right. So what was your number seven six episode?
My number six was What is Starfleet?
Mm.
I thought that it was an intriguing look at the classic Trek moral dilemmas. And it provide, because the documentary framing device provided an outsider look at Star Trek. Because I think there are certain aspects of Star Trek, of the Starfleet itself, that need to be questioned.
Yes, I agree.
There were strong character moments and emotional beats within the episode.
Yeah.
And it was in the end, it reaffirmed the importance of Starfleet's core values. But, you know, I thought that sometimes the documentary framing device was clunky. The holodeck episode, fatigue, the contrived and unnecessary romance between Beto and Uhura was a little challenged for me. And in fact, Beto Ortega's is one of the biggest problems with the episode.
Right. So I agree with everything you just said. That episode, What is Starfleet, was also the sixth ranked episode for me.
We finally leak.
But and I felt like the episode's weak point is that it fell apart when Beto Ortega's tried to portray Starfleet in a negative light out of fear that his sister might be lost on a dangerous mission.
His necessary questioning and desire to get at the core of what Starfleet is about was undermined by it being personally motivated.
Right, right. And if that were true, then we should have seen that all along.
We should have.
You know, we should not have had to wait. I mean, this was the seventh episode.
Yep.
And we shouldn't have waited that long for that to be a concern of his.
Right, right. And if he was concerned about her missions, why the heck was he on that mission to Varia 9?
Right, right.
I mean, I would assume if he had concern about her well-being, he'd have concern about his own.
Right, right.
I'm just saying.
Yep.
So you want to do your number five?
Yes. So my number five was New Life and New Civilizations, which was the season finale.
Yes.
Now, this episode earns its place for delivering an emotionally satisfying conclusion to Captain Batel's arc and thoughtfully reconnecting with Pike's larger destiny, even though the Vesa storyline felt less polished and less tightly constructed than other aspects of this episode.
Yeah. Well, my number five was Hegemony Part 2, the season opener. I thought it was Pike's strong, collaborative command style was on display. Spock and Chapel's emotional arc seemed to have had a conclusion in this episode. And I was happy to see that be as positive as it was, so we wouldn't have to deal with it anymore.
Right, right.
We had the introduction of Scotty in a full sense, although he had been introduced in this season finale for season two. He really had a fuller sense of him in this episode.
Right.
There was really exciting high stakes Gorn action. Pike's vulnerability with his relationship with Patel was also played well. But it wasted the cliffhanger and foregone conclusion with how the story was structured. The Gorn were presented as simplistic monsters, and there was unnecessary and contrived plot points. Like, how is it that Ortegas, who's badly injured, is able to fly one of the Gorn ships?
Right.
You know, why aren't guards walking around inside the Gorn ship when they come out of those little tubes? All this stuff, just questions that never were answered.
So I do want to quote, well, actually, Hegemony Part 2 was number 4 for me.
Okay.
And I do want to quibble with one thing you said, although I agree with most of what you said, mm-hmm. and that is about the betrayal of the Gorn. What the Starfleet and the Enterprise crew knew about the Gorn as of this moment, they were these monsters, mm-hmm. you know, these mm-hmm. creatures who used humans as food. And so I could understand why they felt like that. And that is actually the way enemies are portrayed until you get to know them. And that's what happened in Terrarium. Now, that does not mean that, you know, when the Gorn wake up, that Starfleet is immediately going to say, oh, you guys are good people and we're going to get to know you. But I think that rightfully so, because they would have been destroyed or overtaken, mm-hmm. They were portrayed at this point as monsters.
So, okay. So let's look at another alien race that the Federation had a conflict with. And in fact, in this case, they never saw what they looked like, which was the Romulans.
Right.
When we hear about the Romulan Federation War, it was a very brutal act.
Right.
It was basically ended with an appeasement where they create the neutral zone.
Right.
But they don't have the same kind of attitudes towards the Romulans, with the exception of a few people. In the Balance of Terror, you've got only one crew member on the entire Enterprise who's presented as having this very xenophobic attitude about the Romulans. Because they've never seen them, and they've fought an entire war with them.
Right.
And they don't seem to personify the Romulans in the same kind of bestial manner that they do the Gorn. That's all I'm trying
to
say.
Sorry, but the Gorn were eating you. They would put you, and they would eat you. And I think that puts them in a different category.
Okay.
So
my number 4.
Yeah, what was your number 4?
My number 4 was New Life and New Civilizations.
Okay.
I thought that the Pike Batel alternate lifestyle was the shining peak of that episode. I also thought that the opportunity at the end with Pike having to come to terms with what he had just experienced was kind of offset with the opportunity for this exciting five-year mission that he now had with all these star charts that Corby had given to Chapel of places in the universe that Federation had not explored as of yet. So looking at season 4, it looked like they had basically a roadmap to go and be adventurous. But the incoherent and overtly convoluted plot, I thought there was also some unnecessary and contrived plot points. And the thing that really pissed me off is that they gave us the impression that M'Banga was going to be a bigger part of that season finale.
Right.
And it was just a red herring. He gets knocked out and he's unconscious while Patel and Pike have this animated 10-year lifestyle.
Yep.
That just bothered me. It just bothered me.
So that's why I don't understand why it is your number four.
Because I think it's stronger than the others that fall below that. That's it.
Okay.
And I'm sorry. That scene, the scene played between Pike and Patel is really strong. I think
it is just a few minutes. So
anyway.
Yeah. All right. Well, let's move on. What was your number three?
My number three was Terrarium. I thought the excitement of the Ortegas character development was really good. It was a morality story using what some people have termed the enemy mind kind of concept, but we've seen this both in an episode from TNG called Enemy, mm-hmm. where Geordi is stranded on a planet
yep.
with a Romulan, and we've even seen it in other genres. The Sidney Poitier, Tony Curtis movie, The Defiant Ones, also uses this same complex where people hate each other who are forced to have to work together,
right?
And come to have a humanizing experience. I thought the episode was pitch perfect up until the moment the Metron appeared.
Right.
Because that was the mistake in the episode. That was the thing that I thought was unnecessary. It ended up being erased from her memory, so it was not going to matter as time goes on. And it was just repeating beats from Arena. So, and that's the thing that really bothers me is when Stranger Worlds does things that we have already seen having done in episodes from other series.
All right. So,
what's your number two?
My number three.
Or your number three
was Through the Lens of Time.
Ah.
And so, for me, this episode was surprisingly dark and genuinely unsettling, especially how it handled Gamble,
mm-hmm.
who was a likable character,
mm-hmm.
who I thought was going to be a character who stayed on the ship for a while.
Yeah.
But he became the victim of a powerful demonic being. Mm-hmm. So,
mm-hmm.
So I think we were talking earlier where we said, you know, if you're going to name a horror episode, this was a horror episode.
And it didn't require plant zombies.
Right. And so go ahead.
Okay, you want me to do my number two?
Well, I'll just say my number two was Terrarium.
Okay.
You just talked about it. I don't have anything else to add to that.
Okay.
So you go ahead.
My number two was Through the Lens of Time.
Okay.
I thought it was effective sci-fi horror combination, high concept science fiction, strong character work for both Chapel and Gamble.
Right.
Intriguing lore and connection between the Vesda and the Gorn. And the exploration of both morality and mortality that was in this episode. This was the first episode that I truly enjoyed in the first half of the season. I mean, I like things about Hegemony, but this one was the one that I really glommed on to. And I thought this was going to be my number one. It ended up being my number two because my number one was so much stronger.
Okay, so what was your number one?
My number one was The Saylot Who Ate Its Tail. There was strong character focus on Kirk, classic Star Trek trope formula, and a team up with the future original series cast, an exploration of both empathy and command, and an unforeseen twist and pathos at the end of the episode. But the thing that was the icing on the cake was the beginnings of the Kirk relationship with Spock and Scotty, which I thought was, for me, really enriching.
So no surprise here, The Saylot Who Ate His Tail was also my number one episode, and for the same reasons you just gave. Also, I appreciated the morally gray ending,
mm-hmm.
You know, dealing with these scavengers who mm-hmm. turn out to be humans.
Yeah, man, that was dark.
Yes. And, you know, it was certainly Star Trek at its best.
Yes. Yeah. And so, yeah, so that's our ranking of the season. So hopefully I'd like to hear what you guys thought.
Okay, so now let's turn to Star Trek news.
Sure, let's do it.
So, first of all, what's next for Star Trek? The next major chapter in the franchise is set to arrive with Star Trek Starfleet Academy, which focuses on Starfleet cadets in the 32nd century. The series has a 10-episode first season, following the format of recent Trek shows.
According to TrekMovie.com, Star Trek Starfleet Academy will debut in the U.S. with a 2-episode premiere on Paramount Plus on Thursday, January 15th, 2026. Thereafter, one new episode will drop per week, leading to the season one finale on March 12th. Additionally, production on season two was greenlit earlier this year and will wrap up production in December.
And we have one casting note, and that is Stephen Colbert, the talk show host, joins Starfleet Academy's roster, providing the voice of the digital dean of students at the academy. He'll deliver announcements and alerts to cadets.
Yeah, so he gets to be the Major Barrett of the 32nd century.
That's correct.
Well, at least he's got a job.
He's got a job.
He's out of a job in May, but he's got a new one. That's good.
Right.
All right. Also, news with Strange New Worlds. Meanwhile, Strange New Worlds is preparing to wrap up its own journey. The series is currently filming its fifth and final season, which will consist of only 6 episodes.
Right. So in closing, we'll be back with a new podcast episode in 2 weeks to provide a series review of the podcast, the audio podcast, Star Trek Con. Before we sign off, here's a reminder that if you like this show, help others discover it too by leaving a rating on Spotify or a rating and review on Apple Podcasts. We would truly appreciate it. Until that time,
like, subscribe, and follow Star Trek Age of Discovery on Blue Sky, Threads, and Instagram at Star Trek AOD, and on our Facebook page at StarTrek.com/StarTrekAOD, and our website, which is StarTrekAOD.net, where we offer additional articles on Star Trek canon, interesting sidebar issues, and other aspects of the show, including every episode that we have done since the 2017 premiere of Star Trek Discovery.
All right.
And finally, email the show at StarTrekAOD@gmail.com. We love to hear your thoughts about this show or anything related to Star Trek. But until then,
live long and prosper.